Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is December 5th, 2018. On this show, we deal with the Russian Orthodox Church in all respects, especially its geopolitical significance in our era. And this requires a knowledge of history and philosophy and economics in order to function. The church, of course, exists in a world and exists in history. So other things other than specifically Russian things have to be dealt with. But we do firmly believe that Russia is the Third Rome and all that that entails. My website is rusjournal.org. rusjournal.org. On it, you will find a donation button that will keep me alive. If you wouldn't mind using it, I would appreciate it. Today we're going to deal with a man who I consider a great man, an extremely significant figure, a man who often gets overlooked, a man who historians either love him or hate him. When I say historians, I mean, Russians. Because Americans hate all Russian monarchs. I'm talking about Tsar Boris Godunov, who died in 1605. He's an extremely significant figure in Russian history. I tend to see him as a good man. The general framework here, as I said in my very first book, The Third Rome, as I said in my doctoral dissertation on a very different subject, as I've said in everything I've ever written, in one way or another ever since then. In political science and in history, there are two factions. There's supporters of monarchy in a very, very broad sense, and there's supporters of oligarchy, republicanism, in a very broad sense. Those two are irreconcilable. That connects perfectly with the Eurasianist the theory of Alexander Dugin concerning the sea-based and land-based civilizations. Land-based civilizations tend towards monarchy, sea-based, based on commerce, tend towards oligarchy. Russia today is the leader of the so-called land-based societies. And there's no question whether you read Dugin or myself that land-based societies are the correct ones. And they're the correct ones in the sense of social justice because they're dedicated to the common good. They're dedicated to self-sacrifice. An oligarchy, by its very definition, is a rule of those devious enough to gain tremendous wealth completely out of proportion to anything that they've done. No man should be a billionaire. It's a laughable conception. There's no way to even use it. And it ends up happening that these people, these old money foundations, of course, seek to break down society so that they can continue to enjoy their money. The New World Order is a oligarchic, sea-based Atlantean notion. New World Order is a project conceived of many, many centuries ago, but only brought into existence in the early 90s, where the nations of the world are seen as inconvenient, civilizations are non-existent, and in order to facilitate trade and to reduce transaction costs to an absolute minimum, national borders and the cultures that they symbolize need to be erased. That also has the intended consequence of creating a labor pool so large that it almost reaches zero in terms of payment, in terms of wages. With a labor pool that large, you could do as you please. And that, of course, is connected with the mobility of capital, which is a relatively recent phenomenon. In America today, you know, unions are dead. Even though unionized labor makes far more per hour than non-union labor, has better benefits per hour, has greater job satisfaction than non-union. For the simple reason that they could say, if you promote this idea, if you strike, if you form a union, if you join a union, if you do anything that we don't like, we'll leave. And we'll leave and we'll get money for doing it. We'll go to the Ex-Im Bank in D.C. and get an insurance policy that guarantees our profits. That's the essence of the New World Order, and that's the essence of the Atlantean sea-based society. All history, therefore, in the most general possible sense, is this battle, this war between those two factions. Because the royal society is one based on the common good. The common good, in turn, is based on self-sacrifice. There are things worth suffering for. There are fates worse than death. Your property isn't really that important. In fact, you may be happier without it. The monarchy is that of the father, both in the theological sense as well as a practical sense. He represents everything that our father, assuming we had a good father, I had a good father, what a true father, an ideal father, is supposed to be. But as kids grow up, they want to rebel. This is the absolute essence of the occult, of the arcana. The killing of the king is a way to absorb his power and energy and distribute his wealth among your brothers. That's a symbolic foundation. That's the essence of a republic. The Republic is a group of very wealthy people who will not be told by a monarch what to do. And so they form a state where they all essentially guarantee each other and will not allow anyone but each other to judge them. A jury of their peers, meaning only members of their class, that's what a peer is, etc. It's a purely economic phenomenon. But that's been associated with freedom as such is just one of the many absurdities of the modern age. I'll say this for the rest of my life, but everything that the educated American thinks about the world is a fantasy. And I mean almost everything. They live in a bubble that's not of their own creation, and it doesn't matter if it's true or false. It's comfortable and it's easy. Do you guys ever debate someone, let's say on 9/11 or the IRS or anything like that, and defeat them, you know, explain to them, and they're really attentive. I didn't know that. This kind of thing, and you think you're converting them, and then a month later, you hear them saying the exact same thing to someone else. Their opinion hasn't changed at all, even though they recognize that they're wrong. This happens all the time. Why is that? The primary reason is that truth isn't that big of a deal to most people. In Republican systems, in the broad sense, in the commerce-based, sea-based systems, truth is based on money. Truth is an abstraction. People want to hear what's convenient. People see what's convenient. They see what they want to see. That means they project their agenda onto whatever it is that they're observing. The other reason is if they accept the truth, which they know to be true, that means their entire world has to be turned upside down. You take some normie neighbor or friend of yours and they start talking like us. What's going to happen to them? They can't trust anybody anymore. They can't work for the same people anymore. They don't have the same comfortable assumptions anymore. They become an unwanted radical. Nothing gets me angrier than these media-created rebels who are given millions of dollars to be rebels. You know, when Bernie Sanders was campaigning, they were calling him a maverick, outside the mainstream, this rebellious, you know, tapping into the rebellion of youth and everything else. And rebels are dead or in prison or completely marginalized. That's why they're rebels. That's what happens to rebels. They don't get multi-million dollar contracts with Hollywood. They don't get record contracts. They don't get elected to Senate seats. The official rebels, we call them controlled opposition. You see it in different kinds of music. It's a way to absorb this negative energy that the system itself has created and channel it. The problem in the West, of course, is that oligarchy has been ascendant for so long. Western Europe, America, Canada, for so long that we don't see any other option. But there are options. The royal rule principle is you see it in Putin and Lukashenko. You see it in the Cossack hetmans. You see it in General Park in South Korea, Juan Perón, Argentina. These guys, they're not exactly crowned royals, but they have that very same role. I talked about General Park in South Korea. His whole concept was to break the back of the oligarchy. To say you're going to serve the nation or you go to prison. Boris Godunov, what does this have to do with him? Russian history is extremely different from that of the West, and you can't use Western categories. A classic mark of amateurism, someone who doesn't know what they're talking about, is someone who uses normal historical terms that we would use in talking about George Washington or Ben Franklin and applying it to, 12th century Russia. But we're talking about the very end of the 16th century here. And it's an extremely confusing time. And because of the confusion, there's a lot of historical theses floating around out there that may never get fully explained. We're talking about the period just before the Time of Troubles. And that actually refers to Northern Ireland for a lot of people. But in Russia, the Time of Troubles is the complete collapse of the state in Russia after 1605. And it was not solved until the first Romanov, Mikhail, was elected not too long afterwards, 1613. In between then, you had a collapse of the state, of the army, of society. But for our purposes, more importantly, you have the blatant and very, very clear confrontation between oligarchy and monarchy. Tsar Boris' predecessor, Theodore, the son of Ivan IV, or Ivan the Terrible. As he got older, as Ivan the Terrible got older, he organized the Boyar Duma to succeed him and to keep the affairs of state in order. Ivan IV was poisoned. Examinations of his body show mercury levels, I think, 16 times higher than the normal. Same thing goes for his wives and everything else. He didn't kill them. They were murdered. Oligarchy is manifest in the Boyar Duma. The Boyar class is the upper reaches of the elite. In symbolic terms, they're the different parts of the ancient Russian society before they came under the rule of one father, of one monarch. To be a Boyar is to be representative of some regional class that prior to St. Vladimir realized that they were better off cooperating than in fighting. You have people like very saintly Metropolitan Dionysius II, who's a very good man, but he supported the wrong side. He supported the Shusky side. Vasil Shusky and his Mikhail and other relatives, we'll talk about it in a minute, represented the oligarchic principle. Patriarch Job, Saint Job, the first patriarch of all Russia, supported Boris Godunov. Boris was the brother, or the last Tsar's brother-in-law. His sister Irina married Theodore. Boris was part of the, was an opchnik. He was a part of the elite guard of Ivan IV. You're part of the elite guard. This means that you had absolutely no love for oligarchy. So we know this going in. You cannot be a part of that organization, which of course in Western histories is, you know, like the SS in their mind. But the reason for that is that they made war on the private armies of very powerful boyar clans. Generally speaking, the Shuisky and other noble families supported the Polish claim to Russia. Poland was always very attractive to these people because there you didn't have a country in a normal sense of the term. You had a weak monarch, really symbolic. He really was a puppet. What really ran the country was the Senate and very powerful noble families that reduced the common people to absolute objection, absolute serfdom, worse than any other place in Europe. And the only way they could get anything done was to form confederation. A confederation would be the private armies of several noble clans getting together for some purpose. The Romanov family was a part of this. They were, to some extent, in opposition to Shuisky. But it was also very clear to the elites that the Roman papacy called for a crusade against Russia, I mean, one of many, using Poland as the vanguard. Numerous candidates to replace Theodore were forwarded because Theodore was the last direct descendant of the first monarch, Rurik, who had colonized Novgorod many centuries earlier. That line was now gone. And of course, the Romanov line, a few years later, takes over. So you had a bit of a confusion because there was only one family that symbolized Russia as an entity. They didn't rule Russia. I mean, those terms are totally irrelevant to Russia at the time. You know, the Tsar didn't run things like, you know, a cabinet and have a bureaucracy and everything. That simply didn't exist. The Romanov family was backed by others, Belsky, Cherkasy, Rapin, other families, and they were never quite unified. One of the biggest problems with republics, with the commerce-based society, is based on competition. Not just economically, but really they hate each other. The adversarial system of justice is based on that. Everything is competition. If another family gets a new car, you look poor if you don't get one. You don't know why. You know it's a waste of money. But you're driven to this. This is when the passions take over. It's absolutely at the essence of oligarchy and republicanism, generally speaking. Younger members of the Duma had a tendency to see Boris as the proper successor. My personal opinion, he most certainly was. When Theodore was crowned monarch, it was Boris, as his brother-in-law, who held the scepter. The Duma began to more or less openly call for oligarchy. They couldn't agree in a candidate, so they wanted to run it on the Polish model. And they were supported by Poland and Great Britain in this respect. After Theodore's death, Theodore Ivanovich. They couldn't agree on a candidate. Both Poland and Britain saw oligarchy, in other words, ruling collectively, the so-called will of the people, which is what that actually refers to, as the only option. Duma then went to a Tartar, a baptized Tartar, someone who you may recognize, Simeon. And Simeon Bekmulatovich. When Ivan the Terrible just was exhausted of battling the oligarchy, he resigned his office and placed Simeon on the throne. He very soon reversed himself, and when he resigned, the same oligarchs who opposed him begged him to return, because without a monarch, they don't have any legitimacy. So they live in a contradictory situation. They hate the monarchy, and yet it's the sacral authority of the monarchy that gives them the position that they have. They tried to kill him, they tried to poison him. The minute he leaves, they beg him to return, because the population, hating them, was looting their estates. Now, by the way, just as an aside, this proves, of course, that the Tartars weren't Asian. There's many examples of this. There's no record of anyone being worried that he wasn't Russian. He was 100% Russian. He was a Slav who spoke Russian. He was Islamic. He was born a Muslim before, as a child, but he was baptized. Now, being a Tartar did not make him non-European. He was quite European. No one said a word about that. There was no ethnic or racial concern. They wanted him as a figurehead, symbolic figurehead, because of what he was under Tsar Ivan. He was as close as they really can get. You know, the dream of any oligarch is to get a fake monarch in there that they can control. And so long as people don't know the monarch's under their control, they could use that authority and do as they please. In the 18th century, you see it after the death of Peter the Great, with, of course, disastrous results. Metropolitan Dionysius, who was an excellent writer and a pious man, was not perfect, and he sought, did not like Boris, didn't like the idea that Boris worked for Ivan as an elite military man, and he really wanted Theodore to divorce Irina. And Dionysius was giving all kinds of this ridiculous, you know, canonical reasons why it should be done, and the only reason is to make sure that Boris is out of the picture. This is why he was deposed by Patriarch Job. It was a nasty thing to do. It was a sinful thing to do. And it was purely driven by political concerns. The history books have, Boris takes over and immediately eliminates his opposition. But that's not, in this particular case, it's not what happened. He had a reason to get rid of Dionysius. Dionysius II of Moscow. But because of the Simeon threat, Boris, who saw himself as a natural successor, sent out a loyalty oath to all the parishes of Russia. This had never been done before. The loyalty oath was that they would have nothing to do with this Simeon, and they would pledge their political loyalty to the legitimate monarch, Boris, and Patriarch St. Job. So the Duma convened the Zmiski Sobor, which is the Council of the Land, so to speak. It's the Council of the Nation in the proper and the real translation. This is meant to be a representative body from all over Russia, of different classes and backgrounds, to solve problems. Calling one is kind of a big deal. In its full form, it's a huge body. But Boris was upset by this because he knew that the oligarchs were up to no good. They would never call a Sobor if they didn't think they were going to win it or dominate it. He blocked the roads on the way to Moscow, which made him look terrible. Then they wanted Irina, Tsar Theodore's wife, who very smartly went into a monastery both Theodora and Irina were very pious people anyway, and she really wanted to be a monk, as did Theodore, but it also had the benefit of getting her away from the storm that was coming. The Simeon thing didn't work out. The Irina thing didn't work out. Boris realized that when they called the Zemensky subordinate that there was something wrong. It's not a procedural matter. They would never do that unless they had a plan in mind. The Romanov family was related to Queen Anastasia, who was Theodore's mother. So four candidates eventually show up. There were two Romanovs, Theodore and Alexander. Mstislav, but he was with the Mstislavsky family. He was from Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which was Russian, and Gudinov himself, Boris. The Duma is very upset. You know, Joe being, of course, a great saint, the first patriarch of Russia, extremely significant figure, sought to be the temporary ruler in this interregnum after Theodore's death, and the Duma vehemently rejected this. They knew that he was pro-Boris, but, you know, pro-royalist in general. And he was aware of what the Duma was trying to do. But what happened was that these four candidates began to engage in your typical campaigning, which is what monarchs are not supposed to do. But they're worried about their future. They're worried about support. But when you have an oligarchy, you have division. You have contempt. You have jealousy. They don't like each other. They only make a show of cooperation for the sake of the public. Or when there's a threat so great that they have no choice but to work together. By this time, a huge crowd had gathered in Moscow. I mean, all monarchs, all emperors had to be acclaimed by the population. And without a decision from the Duma, it went to the crowd. And so these candidates, as well as the oligarchy itself, was trying to sway the population. St. Job and the church in general, the clergy, backed Boris. And yet Boris also had said, you know, if I take over here, I'm not going to destroy you guys. I'm going to give you important posts. Which, of course, they never trusted. That's not how they operate. They didn't get to be oligarchs by being, I mean, despite birth, they didn't get to the position that they have by being stupid. You know, birth is one thing. You could squander that. No, they were devious people. The problem with having to fight devious people is that you have to become devious yourself. Boris got word, and this may be self-interested, no one's entirely sure. Boris got word that the Crimeans were massing an army on the border, of course with Turkish backing. And so many of the leaders of the Duma were ordered to go and muster the forces. Now, this is very fortuitous. It turns out to have been a false alarm. Whether deliberately false, no one knows. The Crimeans did this stuff all the time. So now the elite had to leave Moscow or face a treason trial. Now, I mentioned that Simeon was a baptized Tartar, and most people think of an Asian man. Boris Godunov was also a Tartar. He's from Astrakhan. No one in the universe thinks he's anything but a pure European. This is just one more piece of evidence that this whole Mongol-Tartar thing is nonsense. These were Slavs. And the great Tartar families were never called, you know, filthy Asians or foreigners or anything like that. They were as Russian as anybody else. Boris Godunov was of Tartar background, which means that he was of a certain nomadic Slavic background from the far south in Astrakhan. he was acting more or less as regent, really de facto. And he was generally a popular man, partially because he negotiated recovery of some land with Sweden. And Theodore, before him, had consolidated Russia's position in the Baltics, which was a big deal, economically speaking, because this was a trade route, and this was yet another window to Western Europe, for better or for worse. It's one thing to say that a leader bribes his supporters. It's another thing to say that he rewards his supporters. And the line between those two things is very, very indistinct. People talk about corruption in a certain place. Oh, they're all corrupt. But unless you know precisely what he means, it's often very imprecise. So, for example, in much of the Third World, bribery isn't called bribery. It's simply a tip, a gratuity. This is because many salaries in the bureaucracy simply aren't large enough to support a family. So it's not bribery. You're not trying to buy somebody. You certainly are trying to insure your case, but this is something you would do anyway, and that it had to be sought out because of the nature of society. Vladimir Putin had passed right now overseas, the most strict anti-corruption regime in the world. Even the slightest hint of impropriety is punished. And this, of course, is aimed at the oligarchs, his own oligarchs. I mean, this stuff just doesn't change. Now, I shouldn't have to tell you that the Jewish mind fits precisely with that of oligarchy and republicanism. And every once in a while, they may have to shift it for their own purposes, but this is where their mind is. And we all know about the Khazars. I dealt with them in great detail. And they were a non-productive slave trading society that was based almost entirely on charging tolls at the Volga and using mercenaries. Every ruler that ever existed rewards his supporters. He cannot treat elite rivals the same way as his elite supporters. That doesn't make sense. That wouldn't be in his interest to do that. When a democratic politician in, say, America or England is campaigning and promises, I'm going to bring jobs here, I'm going to bring corporations here, I'm going to... Is that bribery? Well, no. I mean, you know, in a cynical way, it is. But it's not much different from what a lot of people think corruption is. Vasil Suski, who will pretend at one point after Boris's death, pretend to be czar, and in a lot of history books is called that, although he was never recognized, hated Boris Godunov. The Suski family was probably the wealthiest and most powerful of the oligarchs at the time, which, by the way, creates jealousy with the other factions, which is a separate story. Because he was an Obshchiniki, before, he knew, and of course he comes from the Horde, so he's from a different region of Russia. He has a different mentality. He has a different way of thinking. His connection with Ivan the Terrible was the main reason that Suski wanted him gone. He will never play ball if he was chosen for that job. But Godunov realized the same thing that Ivan the Terrible realized. If the royal principle isn't stressed, sometimes violently, if it isn't stressed, then what rich people will do, very rich people, outside of any law, is begin building private armies. Armies of not just the workers, but military men, in one form or another. In any given society, if the government were to collapse overnight, you wouldn't have chaos the next day. Or you may have chaos for a very short period of time. What you'll have then is oligarchy. Soon people will realize that they're defenseless and they have to join with the closest strongman for their own purposes. This is the reason that in times of rebellion or warfare, small landowners are often despoiled. Those countries that suffer from concentrated land ownership often are those that have suffered from a great degree of instability. Instability, you know, a big landowner can handle instability far better than a small landowner can. And this was going on in the time we're talking about. And things get much worse. So in this vein, Boris ordered investigations into all of the elite boyar families. Their backgrounds, their financial dealings, their private armies, everything that Ivan the Terrible was worried about. You can't have a civilized country when the richest people have their own armies and their own intelligence services and sometimes their own navy, depending on where they are. Now, in the English language history books, usually are just myth from cover to cover. And I say myth rather than lies because a myth is a fanciful story that serves an agenda. It's a coherent narrative, but it's still wrong. And in Russian history, one of the most insulting, stupid, are from those writing on Tsar Theodore, Boris's predecessor and Ivan the Terrible's successor. Usually you'll read that he was mentally retarded, and he was very weak physically, and all he did all day was ring church bells. That's what you'll see. I mean, you'll see tenured professors write this all the time. And as always, like everything they believe, it's not only not true, but in this particular case, it's a malicious lie. Theodore was a very good ruler and a very good man and a very sharp wit. But Theodore had one aspect of him that makes him a tragic figure, and that is he refused absolutely to permit the realities of political competition affect him mentally. The truth is, I don't care how holy or how good of a man you are, if you're given power, you have to occasionally use Machiavellian tactics. Theodore refused, and he really didn't care what the consequences were. He's an extremely interesting figure. He's a canonized saint. And I think it was one British, hostile British source that said that, yeah, every time I see him, he's ringing church bells. It just means that he goes to all the daily services. And even as monarch, was the first one to ring the bells to bring everyone in. He was just that enthusiastic. There was nothing, you know, it's not like Rain Man, you know, watching Judge Wapner. It's nothing like that. And there's no reason to believe that. In all of the domestic writings at the time, no one says anything like that. All the writings don't say anything about the Tartars or Mongols being Asians. They say nothing about Theodore being what they call feeble-minded. But things are so cynical and bad now that even to try to be a virtuous ruler in the true sense of the term, refusing to use Machiavellian tactics at any level, is enough for you to be called mentally ill. Now, he did repel an invasion of the Crimean Tartars, which, by the way, gives a certain credence to Boris's later claim that we're massing on the border. It's really easy to say that Boris is trying to get the elite out of Moscow. But that wouldn't have helped for long, especially if they would have been victorious. That would have actually increased their power. So it's very possible that it was legitimate. It turned out to be false, but it could have just been false intelligence. Now, this is an Islamic power, a vassal of Turkey, and Theodore organized the campaign against, the very victorious campaign of the Russian armies against the Crimea himself. So I'm not sure how feeble-minded you could be and do that. Those who didn't understand orthodoxy from Britain, and certainly historians today, didn't understand certain aspects of Russian ritual. They're very, very long and very drawn out, and there's all sorts of, you know, you walk into a church and your senses are assaulted. And if you're, you know, this is roughly 1600, you know, you don't understand this stuff. This is post-Reformation Britain, although Britain was never as bad as elsewhere. They simply didn't understand. That is taken by lazy American historians to mean that there was something wrong with him. And what they really mean is because he was so pious, he must be mentally ill. So in 1591, Theodore, Tsar Theodore, repels the Crimean assault. The other thing that he did is that the monarch of Georgia requested to be a part of Russian civilization. This was not any kind of colonial thing, but when you're a small country surrounded by Muslims, you need Russian protection. And this was the era in which Georgia voluntarily came under Russian protection. Now, one of the most strange and significant events of the era is the death of the son of Ivan the Terrible from his last wife, not recognized by the church. And there's some controversy even over that, Dmitri. Dmitri was seen by the Duma as a possible replacement, even as a kid, to use against Boris. There were anyone connected with an actual monarch they were trying to use. As this is going on, Dmitri dies. You know, a toddler, maybe a little older than a toddler. What had happened is that he was an epileptic. He was playing with something sharp. And in a seizure, he cut himself. He hit an artery. By the way, this proves that epileptic seizures weren't seen as possession. That's a common canard. They never were. They knew exactly what epilepsy was. And of course, in this case, is proof of it. They never said that he was possessed, just he had epilepsy. He had a seizure, and he accidentally cut himself. Now, we know that this is true because it was the Suski family itself looking for dirt on Boris who came to this conclusion. So you know it's true. They would have loved to pin it on Boris. And there were rumors floating around Russia at the time that really hurt Boris' reputation that he had killed the kid, that ordered his death. And this is going to have tremendous significance, because you had several pretenders to the throne claiming to be Dmitri, and I never died. You know, Boris, had me exiled or something like that. And again, with all these guys, you have the oligarchs looking for someone that they can use, because using people is all they do. It's essential to the oligarchical, republican, commercial, free trade mentality. It's all one and the same thing. We're talking about very, very general policy ideas. I mean, we're not talking about specific things. This is how the general mindset is. It didn't matter because rumors flew. We know how people are. They love stuff like that. You know, someone actually ordered the murder of a small boy because he is the son of Ivan and therefore a threat. He was not a threat. Because assuming that the histories are correct at the time, he was the son of Ivan's fifth wife, making him legitimate, making him ineligible to be a monarch. And almost every American historian writing on this says that he is a threat to Boris without mentioning this obvious fact that he could never be Tsar, being, you know, the church never recognized those later marriages. His wives were murdered, not by him, but by the oligarchy. As we now know, since Anastasia, his wife, also had a very, very high mercury rate in the later analysis of her corpse. Now, I think the Duma said that once Theodore had died, power would go to his widow. But being a very smart woman, she went to a monastery and never came out. Interestingly, when Patriarch Job, at the inquest, and then later canonization, much later canonization, but during the inquest as Theodore's death, he said, I was there, and he was at the bedside of him. and said Theodore began speaking to someone who wasn't in the room. Very coherently, he wasn't nuts, you know, even though he was near the end. And he referred to this person as a great hierarch. He didn't mention his name. And then everyone in the room said that as soon as he died, and they knew that he was dead because there was a tremendous fragrance, which a lot of saints emit after death. And because of all these witnesses, that's why canonizing him was really easy. He was extremely popular. Russia was at peace, both internally and externally, under him. He was a true saint. And for American historians to call him mentally ill with no evidence whatsoever, because he loved the ancient services, it should show you how much you should trust these guys. Ringing church bells because he was calling people to prayer is not illness. It would be for a, you know, millionaire professor living in Manhattan, but we could say a lot about them too. No local chronicler ever said anything about being feeble or ignorant or anything like that. The Piskarovsky Chronicle, which was almost, not quite contemporary, very close to being contemporary, said that Russia was at a great state under him. It was peaceful, prosperous, and that the war with Sweden was brought to a final conclusion. And the Baltics were brought under Russian dominion. Then something awful happened. One of the worst famines, actually the worst famine in Russian history, hit in 1601. This is, you know, several years after Theodore's death. Boris was, in essence, the ruler. He was finally accepted by the oligarchs, given that there was no other candidate, given that Dmitry was not murdered, the support of the church. I should have mentioned before that you know, when the crowd, you know, thousands of people near the Kremlin, Boris went out there and said, I don't want power. I don't want the authority. I don't want the responsibility that power gives. And that just made him more and more popular. He had been offered the crown before and rejected it. And there's good reason for this. Assuming that he wanted power and that anyone alive at this time wanted power is a ridiculous assumption. Russia was very peaceful on the outside, but problems were just under the surface. Taking power, really at any time in Russian history, is a problem. So he became the monarch and was legitimately crowned and blessed and anointed by Job. And right afterwards hit the famine. It took a long time to figure out the cause because Russia was not the only place hit by it. Much of Eastern Europe, parts of Western Europe, essentially the main theory right now is that in 1600, a massive volcanic eruption in Peru sent about 32 tons of sulfur dioxide and sulfuric acid into the air. This is a monstrous eruption. It reduced sunlight and created early winter. This was the case. So you and of course, you know, the wind was blowing this towards right towards Europe, and Europe had a very early winter. There was a lot of crop failures. Russia was hit the hardest, but it wasn't just Russia. 1601 was a horrible year. The price of bread immediately went up 120 times. Now, how the two factions responded to the famine is really a good indication of who these people really are. What do oligarchs do when a famine hits society? They don't think about how they're going to feed themselves or their family. They don't think about anybody else. How can I profit from this? How can I take the massive spike in the price of bread and profit from it. And of course, that's exactly what they said. Even against their own personal interests. Tsar Boris, really at his best here, used every soldier and policeman he could possibly get his hands on to say, you will not do this. All of your stores will be opened. Of course, all the royal stores were opened immediately. Any profiteering was met with severe consequences, and really, the population would probably rip you apart. But it became very, very clear that Tsar Boris knew what was going to happen. He pawned many jewels from the Kremlin to raise money. He did everything in his power. He really came into his own during this ridiculous famine. I mean, ridiculous. I mean, it killed about 1 million people. The problem with his policies was that as, you know, cheap bread became available in Moscow because of his policies, all that meant was that millions of refugees flooded into the country, flooded into the city. And he sent regular forces into every elite estate and forced the stores open. He sent messengers everywhere to find where food could be bought and to sell many precious items from the Kremlin. But the cheaper the bread in Moscow, the more refugees came. So it became a self-destructive situation. But this introduced equality under the law. Because in a famine like this, so severe, I mean, people say it's even more than 1 million. The standard estimate is about a third of the Russian population. So it's more than that. I think that's an exaggeration. The mass graves in Moscow are about 123,000 people. So it might be an exaggeration. Historians love these big numbers. You know, it gets people excited. Nevertheless, it was a horrible famine, and the population took this as a sign that Boris shouldn't be where he is. People still do this today. This is not something of the time. People still do this. It just seemed odd, and the rumors that he ordered Dmitry killed resurfaced, even though even his enemies weren't saying that anymore. What else do oligarchs do in an emergency like this? So they, you know, profiteer. They raise interest rates through the roof. The other thing they did is increase the intensity of serfdom. All the protections that the commune used to have were destroyed in the chaos. Small landowners were gone. At the same time, if they didn't clamp down, noble estates were looted by the peasantry. This was not the beginning of serfdom. Serfdom really didn't come into its own until Peter the Great, and really into its own under Catherine II. And there's very specific reasons for this. I've been talking about this since my very first book. Serfdom in Russia wasn't all that bad until modernity. There you have a completely foreign ideology and changes in elite consumption such that serfs worked far harder than before. This time, it didn't exist. But given the chaos, serfdom increased. The elite are so arrogant that even in a famine, they wouldn't grant the slightest concession to the peasant commune. The church also came into its own because all the monastic stores were immediately emptied. And again, the problem is when this happens, it just means that hundreds of thousands of people show up. And something else happened. The false Dmitry. The papacy and the Polish government. I'm not going to get into all the mechanics as to how this happened because it's very controversial. supported a man claiming to be the Tsarevich Dmitri, who, as I mentioned, had the epileptic fit and accidentally killed himself. He, of course, wasn't. There was an autopsy and everything. It's absurd. But in an extreme emergency like this, and Boris wasn't looking very good, this guy, with papal and Polish backing, big Jesuit backing, most certainly Jesuit backing, massed an army. The false Dmitri, whose real name was Gregory, really is the beginning of the time of troubles. Now, this is not a lecture on the time of troubles. It is really a lecture on oligarchy. He appealed to the upper classes in urban areas especially. The oligarchy everywhere supported him, claiming the will of the people. That slogan has been used as long as there's been civilization. Because they can't claim God's law, they can't claim canon law, they can't claim grace or theology. It's the will of the people is all they have left. Gregory was able to amass, or the false Dmitri, about 38,000 men at his height. The royal army, without the noble muster, was about 23,000. And Mstislavsky was put in command of the army. Generally speaking, you know, Gregory, his movement collapsed pretty quickly. The Cossacks, however, supported him for their own separate reasons concerning Russia's intrusion into Ukrainian territory. Long story there, but the point is, the Cossacks supported him, and that was the only real competent military force that he was able to have. And Boris began to crack and then broke under the strain. You can't blame the guy. He lost it. He fired everyone in the palace, replacing them with his relatives. He brought in astrologers and Jews, you know, with talismans and everything else. He became extremely paranoid. He refused to leave the Kremlin. Maybe he thought that this was God's punishment. Maybe he shouldn't be there. So on April 5th, Boris dies. In 1605, it was a tragedy because Boris was a very good man. And had things been normal, he would have been a very good ruler. I'm sorry about that. He would have been an excellent ruler. The Bolotnikov rebellion had nothing to do with the false Dmitri. It just so happens that the Cossack forces found him convenient at the time. So in 1607, there was what in essence was a coup, where the pro-Polish faction, using Gregory, came to power. Just 2 years after Boris died. When Boris was alive, this could never have happened. And all that meant was the intensification of serfdom. And of course, he refused to become Orthodox. He was sponsored by the Polish government and the papacy. It didn't matter whether or not they thought he was really Dmitri or not, nor would it matter if he was. Because Dmitri could never be a monarch anyway. He granted all kinds of land to his supporters. He brought in Poles, Greek mercenaries, anyone he could. His retainers were all Polish and Catholics. He had his own private force, and he executed every member of the Gudinov family. One of his first acts as monarch in this twisted tale is that he placed Russia in, of course, the pro-Polish position of going to war with Turkey. Vasil Suski, the oligarch of oligarchs, of course, who had supported him, said he couldn't handle this. He was trying to ride the wave of popular indignation, and eventually he was overthrown. Now, how Vasil Suski did this was strange, because in the war with Poland, the so-called false Dmitri, which essentially was a war with Poland, he put his brother Dmitry Shuisky now, in charge of the army, who everyone knew was incompetent. He lost battle after battle after battle. He was put in there to lose. Now, while Shuisky didn't like the pretender, the false Dmitry, for his incredible arrogance, and he had no problem with despoiling anyone's landholding for the sake of his friends, and he was bringing in people from Lithuania and Poland and granting them whatever they wanted, Wesel Shuisky was deliberately losing the war with Poland. But it was Mikhail Skopin-Shuisky who went to Sweden and was able to raise about 12,000 troops. He was killed by Wesel Shuisky because he was victorious. So there's absolutely no question that despite the fact that he's often credited with eliminating the false Dmitry, the pretender, who now, in a weird coup, had taken over Moscow very briefly. He put a known incompetent in charge of the army, and when Mikhail Skopin-Shuisky, a close relative, went to Sweden and raised a mercenary army, killed him. There's no question that despite, I mean, he did not like the pretender, but he was in union with Poland. There was no question about it. And even though Shuisky gets credit for overthrowing Gregory, it might not be true. In fact, he supported the pretender, at least initially, because he needed his force to eliminate Boris Godunov's family. His son, Boris' son, Theodore II, of course, was eliminated. Every member of the family was. So he used the false Dmitry to the extent that he was convenient. The minute he was no longer convenient, he rode the wave of popular indignation against him and was a part of his overthrow. In no way was the pretender ever a monarch. Every once in a while you'll see it. And he's actually listed as one of the czars. That's not possible. He wasn't Orthodox. He had no legitimacy. He was a complete usurper. And the literature on him and the relationship with Poland, the Jesuits, and the Roman Church is immense. There are a lot of problems. You know, there are many, many Polish elites didn't trust him. The papacy went back and forth on it. His arrogance, of course, I mean, you know, he tried to, you know, bribe people. He actually literally bribed people in this case. And of course, anti-royalist writers in America are now trying to, Chester Dunning and others trying to romanticize him. But I can't get into that right now. The point is that clearly Wesel Shuisky was supporting Gregory while it was convenient. And the point of all of this is that in Russian history, when we talk about Putin and the oligarchs and their role in geopolitics, and of course the fact that in the West everything is under an oligarchy, this is how they function. The Russian political mind was in part formed by these events. In the 1990s, the Russian economy collapsed. It was rightfully blamed on the liberal ideology that had been imposed on the country. Same thing here. The pro-Polish faction took over, and chaos ensued. The famine, of course, was over by this point. But the bigger question was, now this was always associated with oligarchical rule. This is what happens when rich guys have any kind of power. They use people. The pretender wouldn't have been able to do anything without Shuisky and the rest of the elite's support. Wesel Shuisky, and I'm not entirely certain whether he actually was the one who overthrew him. And if he was, it was only for the sake of popularity and the sake of convenience. He wasn't, you know, he had no abilities in terms of a ruler. He was simply an instrument. So you can't call him a hero by any means. Nor was Shuisky ever a monarch. He was just the richest of the elites. And one of the reasons, and I need to stress this, one of the reasons that it may be possible that Suski did kill or eliminate the pretender was that there were rumors that he was planning on using his Polish retainers to slaughter Russian patriots in Moscow. To slaughter the bureaucratic heads, the churchmen, to eliminate his opposition. It would have been a ridiculous failure, but that's what Vasil Suski said is the reason he had to move. I had no reason to doubt him. So to keep a massacre from happening, and he had the ability to do it, and of course with Polish soldiers, there was no reason why they would say no. He had papal backing and backing from the Polish elites. I'm not talking about the monarch, the Polish elites, to take over. Sorry about that again. To take over. My cat just knocked a picture over. To take the country over. And to do it, he would need a massacre in the city to do it. Before he did it, Suski stepped in because I think he was on the list, even though all of the high-level oligarchs supported Poland. They loved that system. This is what happened. He actually even changed his mind about the false Dmitry, saying, oh no, the false Dmitry is legitimate. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I lied when I said that he had an epileptic fit. This is what oligarchs do. So you have two systems, royal and republican. The common good, the private good. Suski is the mentality of the private good, the adversarial liberal republican system. People like Boris and Theodore, this is the common good. Christianity is irreconcilable with oligarchy and republicanism. That's the point of all of this. I've come to the end of my time. Thank you everyone for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.